Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to yet another Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined by Dr. Joshua Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I feel like we've not dropped your title in here enough.
I love that.
it's a big day for the Second Reading Podcast because it's the last day for second reading bills in the Texas House.
Big day.
And that is kind of our setup.
Yep.
We have something of a full agenda for today. We released the April 2025 UT Texas Politics Project poll last week. And so in our last podcast, as we usually do, Darren Shaw joined us and we focused primarily on the results related to Donald Trump, the economy, coming 2026 election. And we hit a few hashtag text ledge things in there, but we usually leave that to the follow-up. Well, today's the follow-up, and it just turns out that it does fall on this big legislative deadline. Mm-hmm. So we still have recent polling results related to the session that we haven't fully mined on the pod. We're here in the inevitable crunch of the last 20 days or so of the session, which ends June 2nd. And so we'll talk today about kind of what's left on lawmakers' agenda as crunch time hits. And as we record, Thursday mid-morning, the members are on the floor of the House with this deadline looming.
Important stuff.
They're doing the real important stuff, though. As we were coming up, there was a recognition for a doctor who had successfully treated
untold numbers of patients.
Well, six. No, there was a number. Was just a number? To be fair, they said 6,000 patients, and she didn't lose one, treating them with vitamin C and ivermectin and et cetera. So it was a good reminder of what's going on in the House tonally right now.
Yeah, we'll probably come back to that at some point. I don't know when, but we're going to probably come back to that.
I believe we will. So let's start with the big issues still pending. Get the big one out of the way, the budget. The budget is not done yet, has not been passed and sent to the governor. Now, that's not a big surprise. But both the House and the Senate have passed bills, negotiations, conversations underway.
Importantly, they didn't start that far apart on a lot of the big stuff either, which is huge. Yeah, well, as I was going to say,
there are not huge differences in these two bills. I think the one thing that we would note, given the predicates that, people have listened to this have heard on the podcast, and, even a couple of things we've written about, both chamber spending plans leave about $40 million in general revenue.
$40 billion, sorry.
Coming in well under the $195 billion or so that was in Comptroller Glenn Hager's most recent biennial revenue estimate, but most recent is a lot of water under the bridge since
then. Yeah, a little bit.
So, a couple things. The slack creates room for the final negotiations on spending items and some of the bills that we'll be talking about. There's still, some swings in spending out there. And, of course, that money is a good, lubricant for getting these things settled. So there are two countervailing currents here, right? Now, one, our polling has shown a willingness to spend more, albeit with different priorities among partisans. And we've talked about this. This is evident in most of the times that we ask these spending questions. This pattern is more or less evident, but it was, pretty clear in the last couple of times that we've done.
Yeah, and I think, this reflects, the sort of the stature of Texas as something of a low spending, low services state. There's a majority, and we asked about 12 different sort of spending areas, let's just call it. And on 6 of the 12, the majority of voters said that the state was spending too little. Now, when I say the majority, I mean between 51 and 59%. So there's not like an overwhelming...
Close majorities.
Yeah, there's not overwhelming clamoring. There's not overwhelming majorities. But on balance, in areas like healthcare in particular, mental health services, infrastructure, water and electric, and basically children in the state's care, and you know, basically K-12 public education, there's a sense the state could be spending more. But when you look at the views of Republicans, who are the voters for the majority party... The numbers are a lot more uneven. It doesn't mean that there's a lot of sense that the state is spending too much on anything outside of a few areas. But for the most part, you see sort of a mix of, you know, the state's spending about the right amount. Maybe they could be spending more. But, you know, you look at something like this and you'd say, as a pollster, someone who watches stuff, you don't look at this and see like a groundswell for more spending in any particular area. And so I think that gives them a fair amount of flexibility to say, as long as they're, you know, increasing the spending with, you know, inflation, growth, responsibly, they might put it. They're in pretty safe waters, the legislature, that is, with respect to the budget.
And there is a partisan pattern in there, right?
And the partisan pattern is the Democrats think we should spend more on everything, you know, pretty much, except for the border, for the most part, that's a little bit more split. You know, with the Republicans, I mean, look, there's definitely a concern about water and electric infrastructure. Those are where almost near majorities of Republicans say that the state's spending too little on both of those. Near majorities are saying the state is spending too little on healthcare and mental health services. And so, like, those sorts of things that are out there, those big things that we've been talking about a lot and that we're probably going to talk about a little more even in this podcast, like, they're there. They're just not, you know, this isn't the space where you're going to see anybody, I think, any large share of people in Texas saying like, oh my God, the state needs to really increase its investment in X or Y outside of, I think, these like real core functions.
Right. And, with the usual, I hesitate to call it an exception, as you run your finger down, the state is spending too little column. The 63% saying too little sticks out among Republicans, and that is... Wait for it, border security.
Right. But that, remember that was in December.
Yeah.
So it's decreased significantly since then. And so now when we look at it, the too little for Republicans has dropped down to, where was that now?
About 40.
Now, again, still a lot, right? And again, this is in the context of ongoing negotiations about reimbursements and all this.
But interestingly, to your initial point, not the highest, right? Because basically water, electric, healthcare, mental health services, all over that.
All over that, right.
Yeah, good point. Okay. So the other, I kind of started that with, you know, two countervailing currents. The other is, you know, and we did a big run on the podcast a few weeks ago about the factors likely to drive a downward adjustment in the expected revenue when the controller circles back around to recertify the budget. And, you know, to be fair, you know, I mean, I think... I've kind of been barky a little bit about the fact that nobody really seems to be paying public attention to it, to this fact. Yeah. But, you know, I would not be surprised if the leadership, you know, are not fairly mindful of this.
We're going to talk when we get to the public education, where that stands and some of the negotiations on that. And I think there is something implicit in there about what are our ongoing commitments going into the next biennium.
Right. And, you know, and again, like any situation like that, part of that, and this is how governance works, right? Part of that is going to be, you know, a clear-eyed analysis or, you know, a policy-driven analysis of, you know, governance. Yeah. The other is going to be, when you don't want to spend on something, it's a good stick. So you probably hear about this selectively in these discussions.
Yeah, it's funny. No, it's funny. I mean, I was thinking, you know, I went to an event yesterday here in Austin, Axios event, and Kirk Watson was there. And it reminds me of a Kirk Watson statement, which always says, you know, it's easier when you don't have the money.
Yes.
When you do have the money, everybody wants it. And what's interesting, we're in the situation, as you point out, where wasn't there another $40 billion? And it's like, and the fact that there aren't a bunch of people running around with wild proposals tells you that even if they're not saying publicly what's going on, at least they must know to some extent that money is not like just out there for the taking right now.
And of course, look, there's a political element to this right now, because it's now seen as partisan. If you're pessimistic about the economy,
right, you can't say that.
You know, people, you know, it's seen as a, it can be reduced by people that disagree to a Democratic talking point, quote unquote. And if you're not, you know, if you're sort of seeming like everything's going to be fine, it's much more, you know, seen as being supportive of the president and having faith. And you know, as we've talked about in here in terms of the views of the short-term impact versus the long-term impact of tariffs among Republicans, I mean, there's something, you know, that partisan frame has set in.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so that, you know, so the budget is out there. I, you know, And we should note, I mean, the lack of resolution on this is because it leaves room to make the last minute deals around spending.
But so far, I mean, I'm not hearing anything that makes me think it's going to get derailed in any way at the last minute. Are you?
I am not. Not in the budget itself. Yeah. Right. Okay. So let's move on to some of the other stuff that's hanging out there that are high priorities. You know, big one that we've heard a lot about in the last, we're hearing more last week than this week, but is property tax reduction. There are also Senate and House bills on this. There appears to be, a handshake deal on this. I don't think there's not been a conference committee bill spit out on this, to my knowledge. And the deal that's been reported would include raising the homestead exemption from 100,000 to 140,000 for the residential homestead exemption, and raising that to 200,000 for older Texans, those with disabilities, increasing the business inventory tax exemption pretty significantly. I'm seeing a couple of different numbers. I don't want to quote a fixed number, but basically from low double figures to low triple.
No, I mean, basically from nothing to like a lot.
Right. So,
I mean, whether it's enough or whatever, I'm not an expert. I'm not saying it's just the difference is dramatic.
Right. It's a big,
it's 10, whatever, 1,000% increases.
I think the last thing I saw was 20,000 to, and then a couple of different ranges on the figure.
Yeah. It's like 500,000.
It's not that high, but significantly higher. Okay. Those conversations are still going on. Whether we get it exactly right, I'm not too worried about, because we don't know what it's going to be for sure anyway.
Yeah.
So
I don't think that's, and again, speaking of likelihood of moving forward, this doesn't feel like something they're going to, screw
it's going to break.
They're not going to screw this up twice.
Yeah. This is not the thing that people, are worried about per se. Okay. And public opinion here is kind of helps explain why we don't expect this to blow out at this point. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways we can look at this. I'll do this relatively quickly, but it's clear that as the legislature has paid more attention to the issue, it's been talked about more, people's ears have pricked up as well. And when we ask voters, three times so far in December and February and again in April, what's the one thing the legislature should be focused on? It's important to note when we say one thing. So we're not letting them choose a bunch of options. So these aren't going to be 60% numbers. It's just what's on people's minds. And what we saw was the people saying property tax reduction increased from 4% in December to 6% in February to 7% in April. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's the fourth most frequently mentioned priority, only behind immigration, the economy, and public education. So it's just to put it, that's the level we're talking about here. And obviously those are other very, very big issues, right? Asked directly about legislative priorities, 48% of voters said that reducing property taxes is extremely important. It's an extremely important priority. Another 27% said it was very important. Only lowering the cost of everyday goods and services and improving the reliability of the state's energy grid received higher priority from voters, and only barely. It's the number one issue among Republicans. 61% say it's extremely important. 26% say very important. It's significantly less important for Democrats, but fewer than 1 in 10 would offer that property tax reductions were not very or not at all important priority for the legislature. And there's a third of Democrats, or more than a third actually, saying it's extremely important for the legislature to reduce property taxes. 29% say it's very important.
And I think, if you got more than half of Democrats saying it's extremely or very important,
Right. And I think that also speaks to the fact, something that we haven't talked about a lot on this podcast. I mean, a little bit, we kind of hinted at it, but the concerns about housing costs, because we think about I think people's concerns are really centered on a lot of kind of the big macro stuff. We talk about just everyday costs for goods and services, housing costs, healthcare costs. We talk about the electric grid, the water supply. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of focus on these really bread and butter political issues here. And when you think about the cost of housing and something, this is kind of what the legislature can do.
Yeah.
And so I think for a lot of Democrats even Democratic representatives who want to make action here, again, you can talk about hanging together and, holding up constitutional amendments and all that kind of stuff. But honestly, this is not the one.
Yeah. It's just as unhelpful in a general election for a Democrat as it is in a primary for a Republican. To have somebody say, he voted against lowering your property taxes, or she voted against lowering your property taxes.
Yeah.
All right. So let's, again, out there, probably maybe some tweaks around the margins to be going. There'll be some space on the floor. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the amendments look like on that, or the attempted amendments. I think, which will be difficult to pass anything. I mean, once they hammer this out, but it's looking, it's on track.
Yeah. It's on track.
Okay, I would say mostly the same thing about the next big one we want to talk about is water.
Right.
You know, water legislation, SB7, you know, would ask voters to approve spending of $1 billion a year for the next decade to shore up the state's water crisis. That's made it through the process without a whole lot of trouble. You know, the issue that is out there seems to be, you know, the balance between how much is allocated for new projects, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of more the preference of the Senate, how much to apply towards maintenance, refurbishing,
fixing existing stuff.
Seems to be a little heavier emphasis on it on the House, as I understand it. But again, with that much money to, you know, that seems fixable. You know, there's a lot of lobbying. I mean, look,
it's a really interesting area. I mean,
as always,
you know, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I mean, there's a really interesting sort of, you know, political overlay to the urban, suburban, rural, and state growth thing here that's just sort of fascinating, right? And I mean, I think there was a report that came out sometime last year that was rating state infrastructure across all 50 states. And, you know, one of the areas that Texas was not great in was water infrastructure, and a lot of it is water loss from old pipes and stuff like that. And the thing about those projects is, I mean, you can see how, like, as a House member with a smaller district, like, that can actually, like, fundamentally impact the district in a way that, like, you can both, one, I mean, like, at the bottom line, like, you know, there are local governments that are dealing with these water problems, but also, you know, even though we might think of these things as disruptive, like, you can demonstrate what you're doing. You're going in and you're fixing the pipes, right? Now, the other side of this is, you think about political competition in the state and the fast-growing suburbs and exurbs. And one of the huge problems that these places have is essentially water infrastructure projects are crazy expensive, and they don't have the tax bases not only to fund them on their own, but even to bond them out most of the time. So they need to have a partner with the state, which is, you know, where all this kind of money gets flowed around and stuff. But that's where these new projects come in, which is like, okay, well, these areas are growing in what were, you know, kind of, I mean, just to say, like, generally more conservative areas. And these are people moving to Texas and moving to sort of these sort of exurban areas that used to be, I'm going to say, they're now kind of turning into suburbs.
Yeah.
And the question is, how do you support that kind of growth? And that's a little bit different. You need some bigger, splashier projects there. And so I think there's a little bit of an overlay, but again, there's something for everybody here.
Yeah.
And I would say that on the polling side, you just see this as sort of just, it's an issue that is, I would say, perpetually been on voters' minds, even though it doesn't have the same moment like the winter storms. Like, we talk about the electric grid, we say when the power went out, that was just like this shock for people, and it's been sitting there ever since. With water, we don't necessarily have that shock, except we know from polling, and we know just for living in Texas, the number of boil water notices, water issues that come up like all over the place, whether you're in Austin or you're out in West Texas,
right?
It's happening. And so because of that, what we see when we say, you know, hey, what's the importance of improving the reliability of the state's water supply? It was the fourth highest priority among all voters. 47% said extremely important. 32% said very. Again, only property tax reduction, lowering costs, and improving the reliability of the energy grid were rated higher.
Right. And you raised a couple of good templates for thinking about competing interests and all that. I mean, the other two, I would add to that. One, regional.
Yep.
Right? Because we have, you know, areas of the state with lots of water, areas states with not lots of water, areas states with no water, and you know, all of that enters into this,
and all the water's owned by whoever's over it,
and right, and and then the piece that is also, you know, just I was kind of alluding to, you know, the behind the scenes advocacy piece. There are a lot of big players that are very interested in water, you know, from, you know, megacorp, you know, the big business kind of piece, to, you know, new market entrants and people, you know, DeSalle and all this. So there's a lot going on there.
A lot going on there.
Right.
And it's really interesting. You know, a lot of increased attention. I mean, just from the press in the state. Like, I mean, there's been a lot of really in-depth reporting on water in the state recently, which, again, is filtering down to people.
Well, you know, and it's been interesting. We've been watching this for a while. I mean, you know, you go back to the, you know, I mean, it's been a big but not inflammatory issue for a long time.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and I think it's just, you know, it's kind of baked in. Part of that is, and this, I think, in a very simple sense, we're playing a lot of catch up.
Yeah.
And, you know, the template for where the water needs to get to and where it already is a complicated one and shifting. I mean, I was, you know, doing some kind of updating for the Texas government class and for the class we're going to do in the fall yesterday, and noticing where, you know, some of the population shifts have been. And, you know, some of it is, you know, we have been hearing about all the time, but also, you know, where some of the urban areas, you know, kind of saw slight decreases, you know, looking at the shifting and, you know, what areas were defined as urban, you know, and how that got moved in part because of census redefinition, et cetera.
Yeah.
Can go down a rabbit hole here, but the point being, you know, just the basic terrain of the issue moves a lot, you know, even as there's this overarching kind of, you know, among those who watch the issue, sense of alarm that our water infrastructure, as you were sort of saying, in terms of these ratings, has really fallen behind.
Yeah. And I think, and the other thing is there's just a Texas overlay to all this, which is like, you know, if this were North Dakota, it would be a lot less expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just because of like, how many population centers do you have? How many people are you trying to serve in those population centers? And for Texas, it's just like, you guys all know the answer to that question.
Right.
It's big and it's a lot.
And it's dynamic.
It's dynamic.
I guess that's the point I was
making. Right.
Very
dynamic. Right.
Okay, so let's, you know, those are the easy ones.
Okay.
So let's talk now a little bit about public ed funding. I'm hoping you'll include a good explanation of golden pennies in here. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I have other math I'm interested in, but I'm not going to.
So let's, you know, let's talk about that. Now, the House has passed about an $8 billion bill with a mixture of teacher pay raises and a, you know, now kind of famous, you know, I've seen this figure added up a couple different ways too, but a $395 increase in the basic student allotment,
right?
Which would move it just, you know, from 6160 to 6555. We started the week with complaints in the House, and maybe it was even over the weekend, voiced most prominently by Gene Wu, Democratic member and not coincidentally Democratic caucus chair this session, that the Senate hadn't acted on the bill despite their promises to do so. Even their protestations that, you know, any kind of, you know, criticism of the voucher bill, you know, had to be tempered by the fact that it was going to be balanced in the school funding bill. So the voucher bill passed both houses controversially.
We can do two things at once.
Has already been signed into law. And now the other shoe has not dropped. And it looks like, you know, we're kind of switching from a nice leather boot to a little bit more of a sandal here, but we'll see.
Well,
so, you know, that has been, you know, that has been going on.
And it feels very intentional.
Right. And so, you know, Tuesday we started getting reporting out that the Senate had a counterproposal that allocated more money to teacher raises. You know, and look, it's not funny, but I will say an almost comically smaller increase to the basement, to the basic allotment, $55, you know, I think is, I'll just say, as somebody commented at the time, we'll leave them anonymous. You know, hard not to take that as a little bit of a middle finger. But that said, the other bit of news that dropped yesterday is that, you know, Lieutenant Governor Patrick was roaming around the House floor. I had it on pretty good authority that somebody saw him looking, you know, kind of traversing the Capitol with a staffer or two and security person or two, looking like he was coming from, you know, the vicinity of the Speaker's office. Now I can't, I'm not going to say Dan Patrick actually went to the Speaker's office. So, you know, not suggesting that.
That's almost slander.
But point being, you know, a lot of negotiation was going on yesterday, which, you know, included Lieutenant Governor wandering around the House floor for a little, not wandering, bouncing around and greeting people on the House floor for a while. And most importantly, Speaker Dustin Burroughs saying, not dismissing this reduction in the allocation, saying a lot of moving parts here, a lot of money to move around. We're making progress. Seems okay to me.
Can I pause here and just
so
you said when we were talking about this and you said something, I just want to, you know, and I'm doing this, I'm gonna
put either credit where credit's due or you're gonna throw me under the bus.
No,
since
I want
I'm sitting
you to,
here going, what
I want
did
you,
I say? About
I want
that?
You to talk about, which is just that, you know, people really want this session to be over.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, and I think that's the thing. I mean, this feels like something that could, you know, there's a possibility this could blow things up a little bit. I mean, kind of how much is a little bit, when I say blow up, I mean, within the realm of possibility here, you know, but you know, it is sort of, it is sort of clear at this point, you know, I'm just, I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, Burroughs made all these promises, you know, to these Democrats about what this was going to be, you know, Creighton was maintaining, you know, again, excoriating people for their, you know, concerns that they weren't going to fund public ed. And now they're sitting here and they're thinking like, so are you guys not going to do this?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the question, and that's why I think Gene Yu's got it.
Well, and this is why I think, you know, I mean, look,
and it's not there's a better deal out there, but.
And the bargaining strategy here is a pretty good one.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, because, look, in the gut level politics of this, mm-hmm. if you think back to last session.
Right.
And the kind of stuff you were hearing as the deal was falling apart in the final days of the regular session.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kind of thing going like, look, you know, the people that want to push the voucher bill really don't want to go into a special session to have to do it or to have to continue to right. balance the voucher bill and the funding bill because they don't want, you know, teachers who are on summer break. And again, right. teachers out there, I know you work during summer. I got a big summer of work coming up. I get you.
Yeah.
Right. All things being equal, though, the calculation of the time was, do we want teachers that don't have to be in class from, right. you know, 8 to 6 showing up to get involved in this and to be in their T-shirts and their mm-hmm. signs and stuff right. in the gallery? And, you know, I think, you know, getting down to brass tacks here, if you're going to say, yeah, what we're going to do is we're going to suggest spending about yeah. the same amount of money, but we're going to focus it more on teachers.
Right.
And you know, the reduction in the basic student allotment, well, it's just going to have to be smaller, but we're doing it a different way. And I'm not taking a policy position here. I'm taking a pure politics
position. There's a complexity here about, you know, again, the basic allotment and where that money has to go. And this is about yeah. making more of that money. Again, so we understand the complexities here about this. Just yeah, say, without getting, we're some of the politics.
But look, if you're the, you know, if you're the advocacy team for the teachers, and you're looking to sort of, and you know, or in public right. ed writ large, and you're looking to mobilize people, it's kind of hard to say, hey, look, you guys got your raises, or a lot of you are going to get raises, and there's going to be more money, but they haven't done the other thing. We really got to, like, you know, head back to the ramparts. I'm not saying that teachers aren't sophisticated or even global enough in their views to not get this.
Yeah.
But it doesn't – it hurts the mobilization effort. It lowers the temperature and complicates it.
Yeah, I guess I was – you know, as you were saying that, and the thing I was trying to think about, I'm not sure if it still applies, but, like, you know, does that logic still apply? So let's say they can't reach a deal on, you know, the public ed funding bill, but they move it forward with everything else. You know, does Abbott call a special session to move
on
that,
teacher pay?
On teacher pay. Because, I mean, that could be – I was like, that could be pretty inoculating for Republicans going into what's going to be a tough election cycle. Like, no, wait a minute.
You know, I think, you know, and that's a good – I think that's a good hypothetical, and I think it's sort of – how many things?
Yeah, right.
But you know, I mean, teacher pay was an emergency item.
Right.
And as much as I don't think the governor wants a special session, all things being equal.
Right.
If I had to guess, I think he would call them back on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just think the politics of it are pretty good for him to do that. And, you know, he's going to be in Austin all summer anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Or, you know, when he, you know, yeah. he has to be based in Austin all summer, let's put it that way. And, you know, look, public opinion wise, the teacher pay thing does play.
Well, I mean, that's really the issue here in general, which is that, you know, they've achieved their biggest goal, which is the ESA bill. But, you know, every time we ask about public education, the ESA as a priority is just so much lower than two other things, which is sort of public school financing and teacher pay. And again, there are partisan differences and there are differences in intensity on these kinds of things. And the other thing that is way lower than is issues having to do with curriculum and like what's going on in schools, management of the schools, like that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so it's a little strange, right? So, you know, if we look at those same sort of numbers again, right? So the importance that voters place on different legislative priorities, increasing pay for public school teachers was seen as extremely important by 38%, very important by 28%. Increasing funding for the public education system, 36%, extremely important, 24%, very important, so majorities in both cases. Establishing an ESA account, 17% said extremely important, 19% said very. So 36% overall there, you know, saying that. So it's a lot lower. Obviously, among Democrats, we see increasing the pay of public school teachers is actually one of their highest priorities. 57, extremely, 25, very. And increased funding for the system was 57, 27, again, extremely, very important. These are the third and fourth highest rated priorities for Democrats after healthcare access and the energy grid. So like for Democrats, this is like, again, this is a good inoculation thing. I mean, you know, whether Republicans, you know, win elections comfortably or by a lot,
yeah,
sometimes has to do with some of these little
sort of things.
Well, and
again, this is where these overarching factors that can seem a little cliched and a little too pat actually matter. I mean, if you're Governor Abbott or Lieutenant Governor Patrick and you're going into a 2026 statewide election and Donald Trump is in the White House, and at this moment, you know what the historical pattern has been, allowing for the fact historical patterns are not hardwired. But you know that the electoral environment may not be ideal for you, probably won't. When you're in a, if you're in a general election debate, should you agree to do one, do you really want to have to answer why you didn't give a pay raise to teachers?
That,
not really.
That might be the most compelling argument of all, right? In some ways, like, do you really want to explain why you didn't do this for two straight sessions?
Yeah, because if so, you know, because it's going to be an attack point.
Right.
And it's going to be an attack point that is used to go back to the, you know, kind of the previous political mobilization piece to mobilize a group of, you know, of voters.
And I think the key here to understanding this is that, you know, we always talk about agendas and sort of rank ordering of issues and agendas. And the point is that, like, this is important, but it's not as high on the agenda as property tax reduction for the leadership. It's not as important as water, honestly, for the leadership. And so what you see is, and when, again, when we look at Republicans on that item and we say among, you know, all these agenda items, 11 issues received higher priority ratings among Republican voters than those three we already mentioned.
Right.
Right. So, you know, there are slightly more Republicans of priorities, like increasing teacher pay than establishing an ESA program, and certainly more for both of those and increasing funding in the system.
Right.
Doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, large numbers of Republicans who, again, would support and even react positively to increasing funding in the system. It's just not as high of a priority. Yeah.
And look, I think as a political frame, you know, much as, you know, one can make fun of it a little bit or it's cliched, you know, the basic logic of the two-step is pretty politically sound, given what we know, all the data you're talking about, the relative popularity of the overall, the teacher pay and the overall spending vis-a-vis ESAs, because, you know, ESAs, as we know, popular with about half of Republicans, a little more, you know, but not in a way that you want to go, you know what we did for public ed?
Yeah.
ESAs. Well, it's just not.
And then the counterbalance here, and this is really important, I think, for people who sort of have been in these, listening to these debates going on for years and if you know what the state of, you know, public ed spending is relative to inflation since 2019, you know a lot. And most people don't. So when we ask, you know, Republicans, and we ask anybody, hey, does the state spend too much, too little, right amount on public ed? Basically what you see is equal shares, 35% of Republicans say the state is spending either too little or the right amount. 16% say the state is spending too much. Put another way, a majority of Republicans, 51%, say the state is either spending too much or the right amount on public education, which I think in and of itself explains why increasing the basic allotment may be a little bit less essential. Maybe
a little more fudge room. And look, it's, you know, I mean, the implicit joke at the beginning of this, you know, public, you know, the financing of the public education system of the Texas is so difficult to understand. It's difficult to understand everywhere, but it's very difficult here.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have about a 15-second attention span for the stuff that really needs to be explained about this. It's difficult. And look, my heart goes out to, you know, the people we know that advocate in that space. Like,
it's tough. Well, and the thing is, I mean, the thing that I keep thinking about, and I've said this to you, and I think you're probably not going to want me saying this because I want to do it, though, because the math is so fun to me, right?
Math out, dude.
I want to math out for 1 second, right? Because look at it this way. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't think so, though. But if you think about the fact that these, you know, a kid leaves the public school, right? Goes, applies for their voucher, gets their $10,000 voucher, goes off, or sorry, ESA, excuse me, goes off, has a great education, right? Now, that money is not coming out of that school's budget directly. But that school's budget is funded by enrollment, okay? So this is why when you say it's almost comically sad. So we can take different numbers, right? We could say, well, what does it cost to educate a student in Texas? Now, a lot of people argue about this. A lot of Republicans say, hey, we spend $15,000 a student. Well, that's if you include all the potential monies and the federal dollars.
Right, which are almost certainly not going to be the same.
Right. Or they say, well, it's closer to 10 if you take in the special education, all these other stuff is a better average. Right. And then there's this other number.
You're coming up on that 15 seconds
I'm almost
where people
then.
Check out.
I know. And then there's this other number, which would be 6,200, right? Which is like the lowest of the basic allotment, right?
Yeah.
If it's $55 a student, what you could basically say is, so if a student leaves and they're $15,000, the really Cadillac number, what it means is that the increased allotment of 272 students would then make up that kid's funding gone.
Right.
Okay, that's a lot. I mean, most of these schools are like 500 to 700 kids. If it's a $10,000 student, well, Well, that's 181 students, additional $55 to make that up. And if it's a $6,200 student, the cheapest student to educate, it still takes 112 students, $55 allotments to make that up. So that's why it's like almost comic, because of the fact that literally if the program is even barely successful, 3, 4, 10 kids leave the school.
In a small school
where the ad, where again, we're talking about like 500 kids, 700 kids in that range. There goes that allotment grant increase.
Yeah.
It's gone. So anyway, just interesting math.
Yeah, that was good.
Okay, thanks. I've been working on it. I know.
You've been working on it. It's like a bit.
It's a little tricky. Bit.
You know, the bit's gotten, you know, the punchline could be a little.
Well, bits with math. You know, it's a limited universe.
I think we call that, don't we call that computing? No.
Oh.
All right. Okay, so let's move on to another issue. And let's go to the, you know, what I have kind of listed in my notes is like the Dan Patrick shot across the bow bills.
Right.
Now, some of that, this shot has kind of sunk over the horizon in a couple places, but we'll see, or in some respects. But that is, you know, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago or so, in the timing of the session, it gets a little fuzzy. But Lieutenant Governor Patrick sent out a signal saying that, you know, there were two things remaining. You know, we're doing good on all this other stuff. We don't get bail restrictions, and we don't get restrictions on THC products, then, you know, he would be driving a special session. And we've talked about that.
Right.
You know, footnote for the students that aren't listening to this, you know, Lieutenant Governor can't directly call a special session. A little bit of a cheap shot to say that, because the Lieutenant Governor is in a position
to create one, to induce
pressure for one significantly.
Right.
So those pair of items, you know, are kind of moving the House in directions that are certainly on cannabis and in the longer term on bail restrictions, or, you know, if we go back to what that makes the point, the issue of bail reform writ large. These are not areas where the House is raring to go based on their track record. Let's start with bail reform.
Yeah. I mean, just to jump off that point, though, I think what people sort of fail to maybe appreciate is that, you know, there's been a relatively steady push in the House really for over a decade now towards elements of criminal justice reform.
Right.
And that's been generally been a left-right coalition where it's been most successful.
Right.
And part of a national conversation. Honestly, when that started, that was, you know, I mean, when I'm saying it's actually over 10 years ago. It's closer to 15 years ago. We're talking about, you know, the Koch brothers, when it was the Koch brothers, and the ACLU sort of coming together and saying, you know, maybe we could have less people in jail for lots of reasons that we may differ on. And obviously, the pot discussion intersects that in a way, even though the issue here is not necessarily that per se. It's the sort of proliferation of you know these shops. And so because of that, you know, the House has kind of moved in a direction generally of like not trying to put more people in jail if they can help it, you know, on sort of technicalities, on minor drug charges, on things like that. Not always successfully, but there's been like pretty, you know, good faith discussions and movement in the way that things happen in the legislature over time. So that's just sort of the backdrop here to say that when you're, you know, when Dan Patrick says to the House, this is what I expect, it's not necessarily just being received as like, oh, these are just, you know, either one party's talking points or like, this is just a slam dunk. The bail reform is more of a slam dunk, right?
I think that's right.
And one of that is because if we set aside, you know, the politics of this.
And it's, you know, path to the basket's clear.
Path to the basket's clear. You know, the policy debate's a real thing. I mean, just setting aside the politics of this, you know, if you just sort of look at the policy, say, well, why would Democrats, you know, support, you know, putting more people in jail? It's like, well, that's not really what this is. Texas kind of stands out in its bail practices relative to other states in the country in terms of the limited circumstances in which people can be kept without providing them options for bond.
Yes.
And so that is like ultimately the thing here. There is a policy problem they're trying to address. And again, we're looking ahead to 2026. Do Democrats really want to be the party that put violent offenders on the streets? Not really. And I think there's enough Democrats and enough variability in the caucus that, you know, people can vote their consciences or what they want and they'll probably get where they need to get.
And the polling shows, you know, it's,
yeah,
you know, kind of reinforces that point.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the thing about this is like, you know, these are one of these things where like the polling is the message testing. It's all the same. Like you can't really get at the underlying attitude for most people because it's really like, so do you think that people who have been, you know, let's say accused of violent crimes should be, you know, like basically held, you know, if we're worried? And it's like, yeah, probably. You know, and so it's just one of those things. You,
I mean,
know,
you could probably give them a treatment on.
Well, we'd have to torture it. I mean, we'd have to torture it and abstract it so much to try to essentially find something that's
not
there.
Get at the underlying reservations that may exist.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that may exist, but nonetheless aren't going to like overwhelm the thing itself, which is should violent people be kept, you know, it should be held.
Right.
I think it's going to basically be yes.
And we should also note that, you know, importantly, this was also an emergency item, so implicitly a priority for the governor. Clearly, as we said in the setup, this is a priority for the lieutenant governor as well. Now, public opinion on the cannabis issue, you know, also interesting in the sense that, like the criminal justice stuff, I think, you know, there's an interesting thermostat. I don't know if it's thermostatic per se, but there is a, you know, call and response, public opinion, elite interest, you know, pattern that is, you know, we see with marijuana as well, where the momentum was, has clearly been in favor of at least decriminalization, tolerance of low level use, whether it's medical, recreational, really, by the time it evolves into the, you know, as recently as a few years ago. But we've seen that kind of shifting back slightly, right?
Yeah.
But the numbers are complicated.
Yeah, it is. It is a little complicated. This is a really interesting area, and I think, you know, this does speak to something. It's like almost like, you know, the golden age, we're in the golden age of public opinion polling, and one of the things that we're getting, and I mean that just in the sense, I don't really mean that problem. Well, I don't know, but anyway, that's another question for another day. But what I mean is, we have such
taking a note on the golden age of public opinion.
Well, just because we have so much, you know, and we have so much from so many different states, and we have so many high quality pollsters out there, and we have so much trend to kind of see. And I think, you know, what I mean by that is, like, you know, we're humans, so we want to see patterns, we want to see trends, we want to project into the future what we know about right now. And I think there's a sense around marijuana and pot attitudes that it was just going to keep liberalizing.
Right.
That as more people went to Colorado on vacation or whatever, they'd say, you know, this is great or whatever.
Yeah, look, edibles is the key thing here.
And the drinks. I mean, honestly, if you're
watching
and the
now the
drinks.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Man, I'll tell you what. You know?
Yeah, I saw somebody pull one of those drinks out of their pocket at an event.
Well, I should, when I tell you, I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about me, I'm just talking about the legislators like those drinks. Because they are not cool about getting, like, really, the drinks? Why?
Yeah.
So anyway, but, you know, so the broader context here is that, yeah, I mean, attitudes have been liberalizing, but, you know, the context is changing, right? And so, yeah, people go to Colorado and some people have a good time and some people, like, eat the whole candy bar and have the worst time of their life.
Right.
You know, and speaking of this, yeah, look, as this has moved, what happened was, you know, again, to point this out, we, you know, the state basically tried to make its hemp laws line with the federal laws, and in doing so, inadvertently created this whole kind of industry out there now of sort of, you know, marijuana adjacent products and all these stores that people are now reacting to. That's a different context. And
right.
I think we can accept that, like,
you know,
that's
Delta 8, Delta 9,
yeah,
all this kind
that's
of
that's going to change
know.
People's attitudes when you say, hey, should we legalize pot? You know, people are like, well, wait a minute, what are we talking about now? We're not talking about the same thing we were
right.
5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. So without going into all the details here, I'll just say only 15% of Texans say they would ban all marijuana use. And that's pretty consistent. It's gone down from where it was. I mean, like 10 years ago, it was closer to like 30, you know, percent or so. It's definitely decreased a lot.
Absolutely.
But it's definitely sat at about this number. A third are in favor of only medical marijuana, a lot of very safe place for a lot of Republican voters. And a majority are in favor of recreational possession, 51%, 35% for small amounts, 16% for any amount. But this is a little bit lower than what we've seen in the couple of years, I'll say in the last 5 years. It's definitely come back a little bit. You know, there's a slight decline in the growing acceptance and, again, embrace, especially among Republicans. And then, but again, taking all this together, it shouldn't be surprising that we find that a plurality of voters say that the state's laws should be made less strict.
Yep.
43%. Another 18% say that they should be left alone, which makes a majority overall. So, I mean, there's not a huge, you know, again, there's not a groundswell for making the state laws stricter. And even among Republicans, 55% would either leave the laws alone or make them less strict. And then more specifically, with respect to Patrick's efforts, 50% of voters oppose outlawing the production and sale of cannabis-derived products in Texas, including consumable hemp-based products, is how we ended up wording that because it's hard.
Yeah.
So 34% of support. So 50% opposed, 34% support. Among Republicans, 46% supported outlawing.
Supported outlawing.
Outlawing, yeah, all these products. 42% were opposed.
It's pretty close.
It's not a great issue.
Right. And so, you know, the word on the street has been that this is an area where, you know, the lieutenant governor is willing to give. Now, I offer that as rumor.
Yeah. You know, one just discussion point for that. It's funny. We have
But it's a believable rumor because it makes sense, well, given what you've just said.
Yeah.
And given, you know, the other stuff.
I think it makes sense in a broader context, too. I mean, we paired bail and pot because the lieutenant governor did. But in my mind, I actually see the movement in this session around pot and gambling is kind of the same. You know, in a sense that there's been this sort of ongoing efforts to either loosen the state's marijuana laws and or expand gambling in the state. And what the lieutenant governor is not interested in either of those things. Right. And is very clear about that and on the record. So it's interesting that the session starts and he goes and says, we can't even run a lottery in this state.
Yeah.
And then he said, and then, right. And this is, we're banning pot entirely. We're banning this whole industry. And that's basically, then that becomes the discussion, not how are we going to, you know, expand access or, right. you know, all these other things. And so it really fundamentally did change the conversation for this session on those two topics.
No, I think that's right. And, you know, it's a good illustration, should we need this, of the power of the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, that's right. That's good.
Right.
Mental note.
And, you know, as an office, this lieutenant governor in particular, mm-hmm. not trying to downplay that, but also the office.
Yeah, that's a really good, is a really good example of it.
Yeah. Okay, there's a lot of other things floating around out there. I think given the way we frame this, we're in pretty good shape, you know, but, you know, the Ten Commandments bill is still out there. Library book. Restrictions for minors. It's this cluster of he says religion. It's really Christianity in the schools.
Morality, something.
Yeah, morality / Christianity. Of course, something that is always out there, and not because I think it blows the whole session up, but because it could really very much take up time on the floor at a time now when floor time is pretty dear, and that's abortion.
Right. You know, obviously we have tons of polling on abortion, specifically to the three kind of things that are really bubble to the top here, which is sort of the civil enforcement mechanisms related to abortion pill, you know, basically acquisition, distribution, et cetera, and civil enforcement mechanisms related to travel support. And the other is obviously clarifying the circumstances in which someone should be able to obtain a legal abortion, usually due to health circumstances. And on this, I mean, the numbers are incredibly clear. And in fact, you know, the civil enforcement mechanisms were, you know, surprisingly incredibly unpopular.
Yeah.
Overall, 54% opposed giving people more ability to sue people who they believe have, like, helped, you know, or who have distributed abortion pills, essentially, in Texas. 58% were opposed to civil enforcement mechanisms to sue people who provide travel support to people seeking abortions out of state. Among Republicans, the pills were a little bit more popular, the civil enforcement mechanisms for pill distribution, 40% support, 37% opposed. The travel... And this is a liberty thing, really, just like you just say liberty.
Yeah, this is interesting.
Among Republicans, 34% support it, 44% opposed. I looked this up. Among the people who describe themselves as extremely conservative, we have 50% support for the civil enforcement mechanisms for travel, 29% opposed, 55% for the pills. So you see where the push is on that stuff, but it's just not popular. Interestingly enough, clarifying when doctors can perform legal abortions, SB 31 here, was the most popular policy item we tested. So again, the idea that, like, all these stories going on and the issues with the implementation of the law, well, I think they've probably gone through. And I know they've gone through. You know why? 76% support this, 78% of Democrats, 79% of Republicans, and 77% of voters who describe themselves as extremely conservative.
And that also, as I recall, scored pretty high. We had it on the science, you know, how much have you heard in the news battery? It was at the top, wasn't it?
It was
pretty close.
It was up there. I'd have to look back.
It was in the top three or four, though, of the dozen we did. I could be wrong about that.
And so that's one of those, you know, if you want to know where the momentum is and where the interest is, it's really much more in this space. And again, to the issues you mentioned about sort of the morality, whatever, I mean, it's clear that the House is, I don't know, it looks pretty clear that the House is okay bottling some of these up.
Yeah, I think that's right.
For whether from a policy perspective or just from a management perspective.
And, you know, I mean, you know, which, you know, kind of brings us to some point to a vibe check, right? In terms of, you know, what's going on out there. And, you know, Brad Johnson, who we had on the podcast a few weeks ago and almost certainly have back, and his one of the morning mailers from the Texan yesterday, day before, you know, was talking about basically just how cranky everybody is on the House floor right now. I'm, you know, hearing that from multiple sources. Mm-hmm. And again, look, nothing novel about this that, you know, it, by as mid-May points towards late May, that people are getting tense and irritable, and conflicts, you know, conflicts that had been, you know, might be suppressed, or comments that you might just keep to yourself, getting a little less harder. to kind of contain yourself if you're in the building.
Yeah. I mean, even a few weeks ago, it was kind of, you could already start to see some of in the committee hearings. I mean, it's getting a little testy.
And it's pretty rough out there right now.
Can we do the song thing? I'm ready.
Sure. Oh yeah. So, yeah, see, you ruined it because I was going to give you,
I thought you were going
to, I know I didn't give you a lot of time to think about this.
Well, I've been thinking about the whole time. I haven't been paying any attention to what we've been talking
about. I thought you seemed a little distracted. So, you know, just to end on a light note, I think it was posted yesterday. A lobbyist, and I was gonna name the person, but I think maybe I won't. But had posted on X, you know, application formerly known as Twitter, an invitation, one of those kind of invitation tweets that I often don't like, but often participate in anyway. But and this one was, you know, basically name a song that captures, you know, your essentially, you know, you're feeling about where this, you know, your feelings about the session right now, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I would have to say, I saw this kind of in the evening. I probably spent an inordinate amount of time wandering around my house doing chores, but really thinking, well, how about, what would this be? So, got a song for the session, if you've been back processing?
You know, this could probably be any session is my problem, but it was a quick one. So I'm going to do Waiting is the Hardest Part, or The Waiting is the Hardest
Waiting.
Part.
Oh, The Waiting. A Tom Petty classic.
Yeah.
Saw Tom Petty perform that song the night of my senior prom.
I just watched the beach house thing.
Because so. I went instead of going to the prom.
That's way cooler, though.
You know, it was a way of also, I like to present that as part of my rock and roll past, but it's also part of my teenage anxiety, probably more than my rock and roll past.
Well, that's growth.
It was easy.
That's what that is.
It was easier to, you know, take somebody to the Tom Petty show that wasn't at the high school than to figure out the dynamics of all that nonsense.
Hey, man, so, you hit it up here, huh?
So I, there you go. So I couldn't really, I couldn't, I cycled through a lot of things, and I'm just going to go, this is my latest, but I haven't committed to
it. I was going to let you do one or two if you
and
want.
That way lies madness. But what I really settled on is, you know, it really captures it as a very obscure song called For the Turnstiles by Neil Young, which is from Neil Young's, it's from On the Beach, which is, for those of you which will be most of you that are not going to be familiar with the ins and outs of the Neil Young catalog, but it's the one, it's an album from about 74, and it's got Neil Young standing on a beach looking out at the ocean. All you see is his back. I think he's wearing like this yellow jacket. And there's kind of an umbrella on a beach, and there's a newspaper that's like just been left there upside down, and it's like Nixon resigns is the big, but For the Turnstiles is a very, it's a very dour song about spectacle and self-aggrandizement, I think, and disappointment. Anyway,
we'll have it played on the way out. Right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I
don't know if we can use. I don't know if it's an ASCAP violation. We can probably get fair use of, you know, maybe 10 seconds of it. But if not, we'll link our songs on the Texas Politics Project website where this post will live. If you're listening to this on a platform, we'll also have data. So just go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Podcast will be linked on the front page.
Also last week, you know, all this stuff, obviously there's a ton of data here. We put together a post just real quick on the site that really laid out all the spending priorities overall among Democrats, Republicans, and those voters who describe themselves as extremely conservative. Spending priorities, and policy support in a post.
Right,
it's a big, meaty tables, but if you're interested in any of those ones, on the left-hand side, you click on any one of those labels. It'll take you to the results. You can look by any group, whatever. But that's all there if you're kind of at the last minute looking for it all in one place.
You're making those last-minute pitches to your, you know, to legislators or clients, or you're just sitting there in the gallery or, you know, watching, you know, your devices and your board during a point of order decision or, you know, some chubbing that's difficult to pay attention to. You know, go look at some public opinion on your issues.
Yeah.
So with that, thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Got the summer crew here and they're excellent. Thanks to Josh for being here. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. And we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.